This is Ruthie from Pedal People here in this recycling bin to remind you that cups are not recyclable. I know you want to, but don't do it, because it just means that your local trash hauler has to pick them out, or the worker on the line at the MRF in Springfield has to pick them out, or potentially it could contaminate the entire load of recycling, meaning the entire load is now trash. So, no cups in the recycling, and ideally, no plastic cups anywhere. Thank you. What are people up to in town? Find out on Out There Wednesday afternoons from 4 to 5 on Valley Free Radio for live encounters from the streets and paths of Northampton and beyond. We don't care if we live out of date. We don't care if we're a little bit late. Gonna make a scene between me and you on my rocking bicycle that's built for two. And thanks for tuning in today. It's Wednesday, according to the calendar, January 9th, 2019. And I got a special guest in the studio today, Devin Bruce, live and in person. Thanks for coming in today, Devin.
Hey, you're welcome.
So Devin and I know each other because we're both on the bike ped subcommittee. That we have these monthly meetings at 7:30 every morning.
7:30,
I mean,
tough.
Not every morning. 7:30, the one Wednesday a month.
Right.
If it was every morning, we'd just be used to it, and it wouldn't be a thing at all. But since it's only once a month, and it's like, ugh. Wait, how did you get on this on that committee, Devin?
So it's a collateral for me. I'm also on the Transportation and Parking Commission for the city of Northampton. This is my second stint on that committee. I've enjoyed some other city assignments, planning board and Community Preservation Commission. But right now I'm back on Transportation and Parking, mm-hmm. which also meets once a month. But happily, they meet in the afternoon.
So we're not going to talk about like meetings and stuff here today. We're going to talk about walking, pedestrian things. Devin is a
I'm a safety researcher.
Safety researcher. She knows a lot about these things, let's just say. I often start the show with a little story from my day to get myself warmed up, my brain chilled out a little bit.
Yeah.
So I was thinking of you and traffic safety today. When I was doing my Pedal People route, I had a trailer full of trash and recycling and compost, very full, I might say. Very full and quite top heavy, I might say.
Ooh.
And I was coming out of the small side street, Tyler Court. It connects to Prospect Street by the Smith College dorms. And as I was coming out this street, you know, I had done my last pickup. I was kind of full before I got to that pickup, but I'm like, oh, I just have one more pickup in this neighborhood. Just let me get this one on, and then I can go to the transfer center, and I won't have to come back to this neighborhood. So I got it all on, put an extra bungee cord on it to strap it down, and I came out of this side street, and the curb cut down to Prospect Street was a little bit steeper than I normally like to see. And then on the other side of Prospect Street, like I'd normally do a sort of wide turn, but there was these two King Ward charter buses parked on the other side of Prospect Street. But there was plenty of room, you know, they were. And so I come and I do a right turn, like sort of like right next alongside them. And then I hear the sound of cans and bottles, and I hear this little tug, and I look back. Oh, yeah, my entire load has, well, the top half of my load has fallen off and has hit the side of the bus, and all my cans and bottles are rolling under the bus.
Wow.
And you know, these charter buses, they've got like dark windows. You can't see if anyone's inside or not. And I'm like, are there 50 people watching me? Are they waiting to go somewhere? And now they have a load of trash underneath their bus.
Well, and I'm thinking about you crawling around on the road trying to pick it all up.
Well, fortunately, the drivers were inside. The buses were empty. The drivers were just waiting for, they said they were taking students on a ski trip or something. But when the drivers, I guess they didn't see me, they just heard something hit the bus, and they came running out. They were like, the driver was like, oh, are you okay? Is everything okay? And I was like, you know, yeah, sorry. I'm just like really kind of embarrassed. Feel free to take a picture if you want. And they were like, the guy was like, whew, Good, because I thought that maybe that truck that had gone by had hit us, and I my heart just sunk.
Yeah, he's worried about his score. He's like he's wanting to be accident free. He's a commercial driver. He's worried for a whole different reason than you are.
I'm just embarrassed that, like, so Devin, you've done investigations of all kinds of crashes, bus, all, like, mostly pedestrian related, or all across the board of
no, mostly
crashes?
Not pedestrian related. Uh-huh. I'm anxious to talk to you about a project that I finished last year, but it was an unusual project. It was work for the National Transportation Safety Board, and that is a federal agency that does investigations, but mostly they're designed to do bridges fall down and buses crash, big notable public interest crashes. So I've done my share of buses and bridges, and when the concrete panel fell on the Big Dig, we investigated that one. It's also multimodal. I was not involved in the gas pipeline crash in the Merrimack Valley this last year, but the agency would respond to that. So the work centers around a group of trained investigators going out and documenting an event. And the question always comes up, which event? Why did you go on that one? And usually it is because we have a special interest in trying to identify an improvement that would make that particular crash not happen again.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that you – so, okay, are there any particular, like, crashes that come to mind? Like, when the stuff rolled under the bus – I guess one more thing I want to say about that is the drivers – they found a broom, and they were on their hands and knees with a broom trying to get cans and bottles out from under the bus for me.
That's very great. That's great. You know, the reason I had wanted to do a pedestrian study, I used to do much more research-oriented work, but in order to move from D.C. to Northampton, I took a job writing the crash reports for the highway office. So for the last decade, all of my work has been highway-oriented. And there's a – if you're a researcher and you're looking at the numbers, you cannot help but trip over the fact that pedestrian fatalities in the last decade have behaved very differently than car fatalities. And I kept wanting to have a reason to dig into that. And I think that's the reason you and I are talking today is that they finally gave me my opportunity to do that. And I designed a study. Investigators went out and collected data about particular crashes. And that study is something that you stumbled over on our internet website, and it brings us here today.
Yeah, thanks for keeping me on task. I'm a little scattered all over the place. But, okay, so when you say that, it makes me think of, reminds me of the crash, the use of the word crash. I was biking through... where was it? Chicopee recently, and I saw a ghost pedestrian made out of coroplast, similar to seeing a white ghost bike where a cyclist is killed. And at the site on the written on the white pedestrian ghost pedestrian, it said "crash, not accident." Hashtag crash, not accident. Can you talk about that terminology? Well, that's important?
Yeah, I'd like to. It's been a big debate, partly because you get sort of habitual. I'm from an agency that does airplane accidents, and they have for years, they were designed to research those, and we have a great history doing that. But we got really used to calling them accidents. And the safety advocacy community started some years ago saying that removes any responsibility, that if it's an accident, nobody's at fault. Mm-hmm. My job is not to assign fault, but the point is a responsibility for safety is a valuable attitude to have. And if you call it a crash, that describes the event, and it doesn't whitewash it in a way that says nobody's responsible. So it's a very active discussion. And in my work in the last few years, we've been pretty careful to try to, particularly in the highway mode, not use accidents although in some sentences and some sort of English usage, we still do. But we think about them as crashes.
Yeah. Can you think of, I'm trying to think of examples of what situations might you still use that word, accident?
Well, let's talk about pedestrians, because people usually say there's a couple of things I want to do. You can imagine that I have some notes here in front of me. I want to give some numbers to the scope of the problem of pedestrians being injured on the highway, because it's a big percentage of people. But I also want to think about the description in literal terms, like a car is going down the road and a person comes out, possibly like between your two buses, comes out into the travel way, they get hit, and the car doesn't have to be going very fast to really injure a body. I mean, this is not another person behind another airbag. This is a 2,000-pound car traveling, you know, 35, 40 miles an hour, hits a body. So the outcome is bad. And if the person hit is unconscious, the police respond, you've got a driver who says, I never saw them. They came out from between these buses, and before I knew it, it was my windshield. They were in my windshield. It's a terrible situation. But the point is that when the story is presented that one-sided, and I'm not taking away the feeling that a driver would have in that situation, but the event would be, it was an accident. I didn't know. One moment things were fine. The next moment it was tragic. Mm-hmm. But I didn't do anything that caused that. And so I think that's how we've arrived at accident being faultless. And it's one of the reasons I want to be here today, is to talk about what we can do both as walking people in town and as drivers going through town to bring more responsibility to what we each own when we're moving in traffic.
You can just keep on talking. Like, I love hearing whatever you're saying.
Okay. Well, let me first put some numbers to the work of. So highway safety has been studied and worked on at local levels, state levels, federal levels. And we have last year, there are numbers that are sort of settled down, and is 2016, and there were over 37,000 people killed on the roads. By comparison, there were over 2 million injured. So you get fatalities as the definite number, and then you get injuries as a much less certain number. And we can talk about that in a minute. But for pedestrians, there were 6,000. So of that 37, there were 6,000 people. So that's, if you average it out over the year, that's 16 people a day that get killed on the road.
Pedestrians.
And the injury levels, I would make the argument that the injury levels for pedestrians are much, much higher than that, than the proportion. So if I take the proportion of car fatalities, highway fatalities, mm-hmm. and take that in proportion to how many people are injured, and I try to do that same scaling on pedestrians, you'd come up to about 400,000 people a year get injured. But the truth is, I could make good logic for why it's much higher than that. You have a lot of people killed in parking situations, private driveways. Mm-hmm. They're not in the public database. And you have people who are injured that it didn't involve a police report. That's how all of my data comes together, is through police records. So if the car was not damaged and there's no insurance filing for the car, then it's entirely likely that there's no record of the injury going to the hospital being associated with mm-hmm. a vehicle. So I just would make the case that there are a lot more people injured than something above 500,000 people a year in the United mm-hmm. States are injured walking.
Yeah, that actually reminds me of a situation that happened earlier this fall on the bike path by my house, where a man was walking down the path. It's kind of a long story, but he said that he was hit by a car on Chestnut Street, and his knee was really hurting him, but, you know, he didn't go to the hospital, and he didn't file a police report, even though someone else called the police, because the police threatened to arrest him, and he was also intoxicated.
Well, and which brings me to point number two. There are a lot of impairment issues, both for drivers and for pedestrians. For the study that I did that's, by the way, let me get in a plug. You could find the pedestrian safety study by putting those three words into the National Transportation Safety Board's webpage. So on their front webpage, there's a place to type in what you're looking for. If you put that in, it's the easiest way to bring that up. And that study was presented at a public meeting in September of this last year. So the study looked at 15 cases, and I tried to make those representative. It's not a research study, so sampling by convenience would be a smile because I couldn't marshal enough resources to do a full study with the investigator groups that I had to work with. But as far as impairment, the numbers are something like 38% of pedestrians fatally injured are impaired with alcohol. I'd like to talk about other kinds of impairment, but the fact is that our testing of alcohol is pretty certain, and our testing of other kinds of drugs are not. So
so it may actually be a lot higher or somewhat higher?
It's very likely now that we are seeing alcohol in combination with other kinds of drugs. And certainly as marijuana increases its usage through public acceptance, we're going to see more of that. In my experience in recent accidents, I'm seeing more marijuana of drivers of cars where we're testing fatal accidents there, fatal crashes. For drivers, the percentage is about 15%. So on the road, 15% of the drivers that hit pedestrians and 38% of the pedestrians hit are impaired above a blood alcohol content of 0.08, which is the legal limit. And then you add into that other types of drug impairment, and you've got something that people need to be aware of.
How does that compare to like drug impairment of drivers? How does that compare to drug impairment or like texting or cell phone impairment?
So I have a list of things I want to work into our conversation today. And that's the second one. If you go to I was at a conference of State Department of Transportation officials. So Massachusetts has a DOT administrator, and he and all of his counterparts from other states have conferences where they get together to talk about things. And it was a pretty certain idea from that group of people that cell phone distraction is the problem. I would like to say that I don't have proof against that. And certainly walking around and being in public, I can say that it is a problem with people not paying attention and looking down at their phones. But it's also a problem for drivers. So the things that matter for the safety of pedestrians are impairment, speed, distraction, and then driving conditions. I think we can talk about visibility and darkness and things like that.
Yeah, cool. All right, if you just tuned in, you're listening to an interview or a conversation with Devin Bruce here on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring, and you're listening to Out There. Let's take a little song break. All right. So this is a song that I've played before. It's targeted towards crossing the railroad tracks, but it's a good survival song in general.
Better stop, look and listen. If you want to live, you better stop, look and listen. If you wanna live, you better stop, look and listen for that train. Don't you rush and don't complain. Don't you try to beat that big old train. Do you see that railroad crossing? What's it mean to you? Do you see that railroad crossing sign? What's it mean to you? You don't want to be another casualty because you're in a big hurry. Don't you try to beat that big old train. You gotta stop, look and listen and learn. You gotta stop. Red lights flashing, what's it mean to you? When you see those gates are down, don't you go around. You don't want to be another casualty because you're in a big hurry. Don't you try to beat that big old train. You gotta stop, look and listen and learn. Somebody's hit by a train. Don't you be the next one who didn't use the brain. If you're in the way, the train won't stop to let you by. If you're in the way, you can kiss your life goodbye. You better stop, look and listen, if you want to live. You better stop, look and listen, if you want to live. You better stop, look and listen for that train. Don't you rush and don't complain. Don't you try to beat that big old train. You gotta stop, look and listen and live. You got to stop, look and listen. You gotta be wise. Use your eyes and your ears and stay alive.
That's Ray Tutaj Jr. Stop, looking, listen. I think you probably figured out the title of that song by now. So we're back here with Devin Bruce. Devin, during the song, you were talking a little bit about the history of pedestrians. Like, how did we come to be like the, the rats that scatter when the lights turn on?
It does feel like that. You know, the idea that we have paved over so much of town and that we have not experienced what the history of our roads were at the turn of the century before last. So in 1900, if you were living in New York City, the streets were a public venue. Those were almost like a public way. They were a park is the wrong word, but kids played in the streets. You walked in the streets, anywhere in the streets. Mm-hmm. But also, as you were getting around, the transportation was provided by horses. So let me give you some context for in London, the estimate was there were 50,000 horses a day on the streets of London. And if you multiply that by 20 pounds of manure per horse, which is about right, you can begin to see the problem they're having. In New York, it's twice that. So you've got 2.5 million pounds of manure a day in New York City. So when cars show up, everyone wants to make the transition from horse and buggy to cars. Mm-hmm. And traditionally, people had been out in the streets wherever they wanted to be, walking in and among the buggies and the horses. And now cars are there and cars go faster and they don't want that throughfare interrupted with people walking. So
cars are harder than horses too.
They're harder. And yet what surprises me is there were actually publicity campaigns to try to shame people out of the street. That's where the term jaywalking came from. Jays were kind of like country bumpkin birds that were looking up to be, you know, amazed at the big city. And there was an effort to try to develop public campaigns to get people to only cross streets at certain designated places. In other words, stay out of my way unless it's an intersection. So I think now what I have a feeling about is that we have created a sense of entitlement that everyone traveling in a car has a priority over people crossing. Now, I know that's not everyone's attitude. I don't mean to imply that, but we know how disproportionate the risk is if a car hits a person, and what that means is the people have been sort of placed in a situation of being more responsible for their safety than the driver of the car is. It's just the outcomes demand that. But I think as we become a more aware culture and encourage walking both for its social benefits, its social interaction, and its health benefits, that we need to pull back that balance and make it more inviting for people to walk.
Yeah, absolutely.
And bike, just for you, Ruthie, and bike.
Thanks. Yeah, I was thinking about like when there were all these horses in the early 1900s, how many of those horse trips could have been avoided by people walking or biking? Like how many of them were like truck trips where they needed to carry stuff, or how many of them were people choosing to be carried by a horse when maybe they could have moved their bodies themselves?
Well, and I don't have the numbers, but surely there were a lot of transportation by bikes. It was very popular at that point, because if you were traveling as an individual, you wouldn't take your buggy and your horse and all of that. If it was just you, you'd get on a bike.
Yeah. Well, I think the League of American Wheelmen, it was called at the time, they were like the main advocates for paving the cobblestones, right?
Right.
I think.
Well, and what that has done is it's increased the speed of our travel. So that's another topic that I would love to work into our discussion today is there's some really good research by the AAA Foundation, which is the research arm of AAA, the Car Association. The study that I referred to last year was by Brian Teft, and what he did was look at the speed of all the fatal accidents over a long period of time. And I'm gonna refer to a bar chart here, but it's pretty simple. The faster you're going, the more likely you are not to live if you're hit by a car. So,
the faster the car is going,
yes,
the
more
less light,
more deadly it is.
The more deadly it is for the pedestrian,
right? Yeah. So his looking at a large number of cases, came up with these proportions. If a car is going 23 miles an hour, so that's a slow neighborhood speed, and hits a person, there's a 25% chance that the person dies. So that's the low end of this story. Mm-hmm. If the speed increases to 31 miles an hour, the chances are 50-50. So at 31 miles an hour, 50 people won't live if they get hit, 50%. Mm-hmm. If you increase the speed to 39 miles an hour, it's 75%. And if you are going a speed of 46 miles an hour or faster, 90% of everyone who gets hit by a car is fatally injured. So the big takeaway from that is speed matters. And I think about changes to my own driving behavior. I love telling people that I live in a town where you go around town on a bicycle and do the trash collection all year long in New England winters. I love the fact that I try to walk into town, that I'm just at that edge where it's enticing for me to walk in. Mm-hmm. And I will get out of my house and I'll scrape my windshield and I'll get in my car and I'll go downtown and I will actually see people that were walking past my street that get downtown at the same time I do. The point about speed that I want to make is that we all think that if I could just go a little faster, it matters. But if you look at operations research and the flow of traffic, you're going to get caught by stoplights. You're going to get a sequence of uncontrolled timing changes in your travel. And usually it just negates any speed difference that you think you're getting by going a little faster. So my plea for us is to go 25 miles an hour through town, that you'll probably get to your destination exactly at the same time.
So currently the prima facie, pardon my Latin, speed limit, like the, you know, otherwise where it's not posted, the speed limit is it still 30 miles an hour? Because do you know where the discussions are? Is it going down to 25 miles an hour? Or what's going on with that?
I actually don't know rulemaking of that. I know that there are towns that have made those rule changes. New York is the most obvious prominent one, where unless it is posted, it is 25 miles an hour. Okay. And that is an action that the town has to actually get behind to do it, because currently that's counter to the default state speed limit.
And the default state speed limit, is that 30 in towns or...? It's okay if you don't
know. Grimacing at 30 or 35. Okay. I think it's, I know it's not 25, and that's what I wish it were.
Yeah, okay. See, I was pretty sure that Northampton, that the city council, that they were moving to make it 25. But then there's also the pace car program. When you're talking about seeing me and my coworkers pedal people on bike trailers, I'm like, yeah, I want a pace car sticker on the back of my trailer.
I'll get you one. You know, let's explain pace car. I had one. It was started years ago by the Transportation and Parking Commission, and it was a voluntary statement by citizens that you would drive no faster than the speed limit, and you, if you made that pledge, you could go in and get a little triangular sticker symbol for the back of your car that designated your car as a pace car. And in fact, if you're going the speed limit, the person behind you is too. So that was the thought behind that. I liked it very much. And there's a conversation to regenerate that action. And I like it very much.
Did you say you had one?
I did have one, yes.
Did you ever get any comments on it?
You know, I didn't. But I think at the time it was pretty popular. People knew what it was. But I also think that it gave you that little bit of satisfaction that if you got the car behind you blowing horn at you, you'd say, oh, no, I'm a pace car. See?
If you just tuned in, you're listening to an interview with Devin Bruce. Devin's a transportation researcher and resident of Northampton. This is Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. All right, what's next on your list, Devin?
You know, there's a visibility issue about pedestrians. One of the outcomes of my study was to talk about improved vehicle lights. I'm not a fan of the idea that we ought to put in street lights everywhere. I don't believe you can light up the world and protect pedestrians by making them more visible in that way. I would say to everyone in your listening audience that reflectors on your bags, on your shoes, on your kid's bag, your kid's shoes are a good thing. And I'd like to give credit to the police department here in town that took a large number of those into their program of handing them out to the community. And
because you got a bunch of cases of reflective strips from
I did.
Your worker.
I threw some industry connections. I did have lots of them, and that reflective material tries to make the most out of the headlight that is hitting it. Which brings me to vehicle headlights, which...
Wait, can I talk about the reflective stuff a little bit more?
Sure.
Yeah, at the Pedal People holiday party last year, I gave a bunch out.
Good for you.
But the reflective thing, like when I'm on the bike path or the rail trail at night, the reflectors are amazing. I mean, it's rare, I think, in other places in town where it's dark and a little bit of light will make a little bit of reflector just illuminated. And the other night I was biking into town, and ahead of me, it was a man walking his bike, and between the bike pedals or the bike reflector or his shoes or his backpack, it was almost like a Christmas tree lit up.
Yep. Well, you know, and the thing about reflectors is they're best when you put them on something that is moving. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to put it on yourself, put it on your shoes, put it on your cuffs of your jacket, mm-hmm. Because that shows movement and it draws attention, and it's a safety factor that matters.
Yeah. All right, so you're talking about car lights, headlights?
Yeah, so what the reflectors do is pick up car lights, and if you are studying the technology of vehicle lighting, there is a difference in what we demand for a standard in the United States compared to other countries. So it's not only Europe, but I'll use that as a comparison. Lighting of several decades ago led us to develop requirements for vehicle lights that looked at the quality of the light output of the bulb. And we defined a car light as having a low light beam and a high light beam. And we said to the manufacturer of that car, if the bulb has the right output, then that's an acceptable lighting system. Over the decades that happened since the 1980s and 90s, what we have found is they're very sophisticated lighting systems that can sense the oncoming traffic. So one of the problems with lighting is that for two cars approaching each other, you have glare if you leave your lights on high. What that means is you're diminishing the sight capability of the oncoming driver. Mm-hmm. So car lighting systems want to prevent glare, and that's why you have low beams and high beams. But in Europe, on cars that are more progressive in thinking about how to use their lighting, they can have a sensor that says, I'm approaching a car, the car is in this quadrant of my lighting field of view, and therefore I'll block out my lights just there, mm-hmm. but I will give my driver the benefit of seeing all the rest of the field of view lit up, but I'm not going to harm the driver's vision coming towards me. Mm-hmm. So it's a much more dynamic, sophisticated lighting system, and particularly for pedestrians, I think there's value in that. And I actually ran into car manufacturers lobbying policymakers in the United States to change the regulations so that they didn't have to have dumber lighting systems on our cars than they were building for Europe or Asia.
So the car manufacturers wanted to have the same as the European standards?
Yeah, it's called harmonization, mm-hmm. but they don't want to have to build special for different markets.
Yeah. Talking about glare and lights, I also want to mention that that's a problem on the bike path, too. Some cyclists have really bright headlights. I've actually seen them advertised in magazines, retina-searing headlights. Like, who wants their retina seared, really? So I want to put out a plug to cyclists. It's really easy for cyclists to shield the part of the light that blinds someone else. I just usually put my hand over part of the light, so it doesn't shine in an oncoming pedestrian or cyclist's face. But yeah, be aware if you're out there on the bike path at night, how bright your headlight looks from an oncoming person.
We also have car systems that the lights turn when you turn your steering wheel. Huh. So one of the common problems for drivers not seeing pedestrians is you get ready to turn left off of South uh-huh. Street, and that cross street crosswalk has someone in it, but you're looking down the street. Uh-huh. And so there are car systems now where the light itself turns to look where you have pointed the steering wheel to go, and that's an advantage.
Oh, that's cool. I think I want to take another little break and play another song. you know what? Well, we were talking about walking and stuff. I'm going to play Patsy Cline.
I go out walking after midnight.
To out there on Valley Free Radio. I'm Ruthie Woodring, and my guest here is Devin Bruce, and we're talking about transportation safety, well, pedestrian safety in particular, as it relates to motorists and crashes and stuff. We were just talking about lighting and lights on headlights. Where were we?
Yeah, we were. And, you know, we were talking about the lighting systems on vehicles, but the reason that's so important is that nearly half of all pedestrians are killed in dark. In conditions of darkness. And there's actually been research about when you change to daylight savings time, how much more dangerous that is. So it's a arbitrary situation to change the clock and then see how that affects the fatality rate. So yes, be more careful at night because it's harder to be seen at night. Mm-hmm. If you're walking down a road, walk towards the traffic, not because that makes the crash any different if you get hit, but because you can then see what the traffic is doing. That's really the basis for that. Mm-hmm. And there's also, just by way of caution to people about their own safety, most people are the highest number of fatalities are not actually at intersections. And I think, though I don't have research to prove this, is that drivers expect people to cross at intersections. There are crosswalks there. So it's the unexpected things that people do that make it harder for drivers to anticipate what's happening. And I want drivers to drive worried about what might happen, the anticipation of looking to both sides of the crosswalk before you get there mm-hmm. is a really serious factor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in terms of what drivers and pedestrians can do. One thing we talked about is like not be under the influence of some sort of drug or electronic device. Speed, that was the other, slow down.
Drivers should slow down. Conspicuity is the big fancy word for making sure that you get seen by the driver.
Yeah.
I it's a mixed bag on the idea of dark black jackets. There's some research that says wearing lighter color clothing improves your visibility, but not as much as a reflective surface. So I'm much more an advocate of reflectors at this point than I am white jackets.
So, Devin, when there's a crash and you get called in to research, you know, what happened, like, what's that like?
Yeah, usually my history has been around bigger crashes, and I go out with a team of investigators who each have a specialty. So there's a vehicle person, there's a civil engineer who's the highway person that looks at site distances and mapping issues. There is, particularly if it's a bus or a commercial operator, there's a someone who understands the regulations around commercial driving and companies. There's a survival factors person who looks at how did the crash allow someone to get out or get away. In other words, if you were alive, could you get out? And what did the vehicle do to protect you? And I would like to say our vehicles protect us much better now than they used to many years ago. So airbags, seat belts, those factors really matter. And we've made cars much safer. But once we decide to launch on a case, if it is a bus crash and there's 50 or more people and the local police are there and we get there within hours, we will start trying to document everything we can about the crash, and we work in conjunction with the local police department. And generally, they're very happy to have us there because those are overwhelming when you think about how much work has to get done to document all of the people involved in a mass casualty incident. Mm. The pedestrian study that we referred to earlier is very different than that. A pedestrian crash, even a fatal crash, will get a call to the police through 911. The police will send out someone to document it. The EMS people will come and determine what the situation is on the scene or take the person to the hospital. But the takeaway for me as an investigator is that evidence is so fragile that it's gone within about 2 hours. Mm. So what it involved in order to do a study of them was to have the police, as soon as they received the 911 call, they called my investigators and we went out right then. And that had to be a much lighter, smaller, more nimble investigative process than if we were called to a bridge collapse or a bus crash. And it involves a whole range of, whether it's the city police department, whether it's the state police, there's different levels of investigations that go on. I'd like to give a plug for the Northampton police, who I went and talked to about their work in order to develop my data collection form. And for my 15 cases that we went out on, I asked the investigative teams to do a standard data collection, and that is now public and available to others to see. But it's a very the evidence is very different when you're talking about a pedestrian crash. If two vehicles hit each other, I can actually look at the physics and the forces and the weight and the airbag data recorder and get a lot of information about speed and direction, and I can reconstruct that accident. There is in Northampton and every police department, there's an accident reconstructionist whose job is to document the physics of the event. Mm-hmm. And for a pedestrian crash, that's just very different.
Yeah.
There are situations you want to know whether the person that was hit was thrown off to the side, whether they went up over the vehicle. It can be a kind of gruesome job, but the fact of the matter is we want to know how the crashes happen, because believe it or not, it can really matter the design of the vehicle itself. And you would think, well, if the vehicle isn't this big abrasive front, you know, like a envision a F-350 pickup truck that has a huge, uh-huh. tall front uh-huh. grill, uh-huh. You would think that would be a terrible, you know, impact. Uh-huh. But it distributes the load somewhat, mm-hmm. whereas uh-huh. if you have a small little wedged front on a small car, uh-huh. that might kind of, like a plow, pick up a body and roll it over. Uh-huh. So there are people who actually look at the mm-hmm. vehicle design itself to see what might be less injurious to people on the road.
So with these crashes, are you mostly, you said it's very time sensitive to reconstruct them. So are you mostly just doing local ones, or how far do you travel?
I started out local. For me, local was Washington, D.C. So that was three states, Maryland, Virginia, and D.C. But based on some relationships that I had with other police departments, we also picked up a case in Maine, one in Minnesota, one in Wisconsin, one in Connecticut, and as I said earlier, it didn't qualify as representative research, but we did make an effort to try to find the kinds of cases that allowed us to talk about the different kinds of situations that are in the national data.
Mm-hmm. And I'm remembering a crash within the last year or two. It was a pretty famous crash with a bus that you went to. I don't know if you've been to a lot of crashes, so I don't know if you know which one I'm talking about.
Well, the ones that get in the news are the ones that have either like baseball teams or high school bands, or, you know, they vary. What I'd really like to leave you with, as long as we mention buses, is I love bus travel. It's mm-hmm. a very safe mode of travel, and based on work over the last decade, you have seatbelts on new buses now. Use them. It seems counter to what you think about doing, but you are in a big voluminous cylinder going down the road. And those seatbelts really matter in a bus to hold you in place in case there's a sudden change of velocity.
Mm. All right. I ride the bus all the time, but I thought that like the compartmentalization method of bus safety was
It's a great word for school buses that are designed that way. But when you're on a commercial bus, mm-hmm. That design is very different mm-hmm. for seats.
All right. Well, thanks so much for coming in, Devin. We've been listening to Devin Bruce, a crash researcher. Anything else you want to say about here?
No, go slow. It matters. You have a responsibility when you drive. You know, I don't want to sound preachy, but it's not an accident. It's a crash.
All right. Well, stay tuned for Democracy Now, coming up at 5:00. And this is Out There. I've been your host, Ruthie Woodring. Last week when I did my show, I said I was going to try and do this little series of letters of the week, letters that I've written during the week. And so I have a letter that I wrote this week. This is a letter to Eduardo Samaniego, who's detained by ICE in Georgia, who's from most recently from Western Mass.
5 January 2019. Hi, Eduardo. I hope they let this envelope in. Some jails don't, because only black and white things are allowed. Pretty crazy. But there's a lot of crazy stuff. They say you are or have been in SEG with lights on 24/7. That seems really hard to not go crazy. Lights at night annoy me. Well, I'm trying to think if I have any stories to share. I'm thinking of last night. I was biking down the bike path in the dark, and I came up behind a man walking his bike, no lights. I thought maybe he was walking his bike because he didn't have a headlight, and I did. So since we were headed the same direction, I slowed and said, "You want a light? You want to share my light?" "No, that's okay. I'm fine walking." I realized this figure in the dark was someone who often hangs out on the bench by our house, and we've spoken numerous times before. He may be moving from the category of acquaintance into friend. We talked a little more, and then I went on my way. But it made me think of how we see figures in the dark, and we often think they're strangers. And some people may be afraid, but so often the strangers in the dark are people we know, our neighbors. And we're all walking around in the dark being afraid of each other because we lack the vision to see who's really there. Well, I'm not trying to preach, just trying to say something mildly entertaining. I hope you're getting lots of letters, but not so many that you feel bad for getting more than other people. So you probably don't know me. I don't know if we've ever spoken, but I've seen you at events and read about your history and efforts to protect human rights. And now you're a total poster child for the Worker Center. I hope that's not too stressful. Thank you for coming to this country and being a bold defender of democracy. I hope you're able to stay. I wish you peace and resilience and freedom and a rapid recovery from ways this experience may be wearing you down. Sincerely, Ruthie Woodring. P.S. They say you want news or interesting things to read, so I ripped out some pages of a magazine I found in someone's recycling.
All right, and before the hour ends, I also have an announcement from Frances Crowe about tonight's film.
The film tonight at the media room of Forbes Library is, it starts at 6:30, is Boys Like Us. It's made by a senior in high school last year, explores masculinity in progressive communities and how men participate in gender equality. Three Northampton men interviewed in the film, Tom Weiner, Thomas Schiff, and Bill Dwight, will participate in the Point Film Panel discussion following room. We think it will be a big drawer for tonight.
All right, that's tonight, January 9th.
Tonight, January 9th at 6:30. That's part of the Northampton Committee to Stop War series, the second and fourth Wednesday of every month. And thanks for tuning in to Out There, and I'll be back next Wednesday. Democracy Now! Will be on in 1.5 minutes.
Wednesday nights, you might tune in to the Warm Heart of Africa to hear the funky, sinuous rhythms of Afrobeat. Or the pulse of Algerian rhyme music. Or the desert trance of Tuareg blues. Or Township Jive from Johannesburg. Or catchy soukous beats from the Congo. Those are just a few examples of what you might hear from 7 to 9 every Wednesday night right here on Valley Free Radio. Join me, your host, DJ Vinyl Scratch, on the Warm Heart of Africa, a celebration of African and Afro-diaspora music, culture, and history, delivered with a groove.